I'm Erica Allen Kim. I am the author of Building Little Saigon, Refugee Urbanism in American Cities and Suburbs. I am a professor of architectural history and urban design history at the University of Toronto.
Welcome to The Vietnamese. I'm your host, Kenneth Nguyen. Being part of a culture of nearly 100 million Vietnamese people in the world today comes with a lot of pain, proud history, and privilege. Join me as I highlight and explore the Vietnamese experience from all over.
Thank you so much for coming on the podcast. Your book, the title is Building Little Saigon, and the scope is a lot bigger than what the title represents. And I want to suggest to our audience right off the bat that they should pick up a copy when they get a chance, because it's a book that's beyond just architecture.
Thank you. Yeah, it's I know I call it refugee urbanism, but it really encompasses public art making, storefront museums, urban planning, design guidelines, shopping centers. It kind of runs the whole gamut. And architecture itself is not really treated, I call it like with a capital A. You're not going to hear about, you know, these famous architects. This is really what I call the study of everyday buildings and landscapes, or vernacular architectural studies. And so the things that I talk about, the places and spaces that I describe, should be familiar to almost anyone. You don't have to travel around to find these sort of landmark buildings. They're just, it's like your mom and pop convenience store and your strip mall and all of those spaces that you already know.
You and I have this odd intersection. I'm Vietnamese, you're Korean American, and I grew up in Koreatown in Los Angeles.
No way.
Yeah. So I got to see the development of Koreatown, of K-Town here in LA as I was growing up. Very different architecturally than Little Saigon in California, Westminster. But you know, you're a Korean American, and I'm baffled why a Korean American would spend so many years researching a book like this. I'm really baffled, and I'm impressed.
Well, you know, I think having a little bit of separation personally between like who you are and what you're studying for me is really important. I would find it really hard. I know I have colleagues and friends who do write about the things that they know and their own culture. I would find it like a little bit hard. I'm almost like embarrassed to delve into it. And also you're so deep into it, it's hard to sort of have a broader perspective. But for me, and I talk about it a bit in the intro, not in sort of the chapters of the book, but for me, growing up in Long Beach, California, where K-Town was a little bit far away for us. My parents actually, they lived in K-Town, they moved to Long Beach, but we always went to Garden Grove. We never called it Koreatown or Little Seoul or anything like that. It was just going to Garden Grove. And we'd go to Garden Grove on the weekends, and I knew there was this other place on the other side of the 22 freeway that was Vietnamese. And it was like this weird kind of parallel worlds that I didn't fully understand, but I was so curious. I was so intrigued by the sort of the differences as well as the similarities between the communities. And, you know, for me, maybe it's a little bit of envy, but I found like the Little Saigon was, it felt more interesting to me growing up. You know, I just thought the architecture was more interesting. The food was better. You know, the clothing, the colors, like everything about the Little Saigon seemed so rich. And Garden Grove felt kind of dusty and a little bit, you know, parochial and dingy. Like it didn't seem very interesting. I couldn't see it for what it was. And by studying Little Saigon, I developed a newfound sort of appreciation and understanding for Koreatown. So I kind of came back to my community by studying other communities, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it makes perfect sense. It's so crazy that you just said that, because when I started the podcast a few years ago, I'd always been on this tear of comparing Vietnamese culture to Korean culture, the complexities of how far the Korean culture and entertainment has come. I've pulled back away from that because of my work with a lot of Korean Americans professionally. And, you know, we share so much in common, but to hear you say that there was something more shiny on the other side of the freeway is so funny to me. It's comedic because I'm the one who's always like, you know, look at Korea, look at what they've done, you know,
yeah.
Now hearing my counterpart talk about the opposite, it's just strange to hear that.
The grass is always greener on the other side of the freeway, right? You know, this is the SoCal way. You're always, you know, and I think that's just kind of human nature, right?
Yeah.
To be really more intrigued by something that is almost like, but not. And it's this weird kind of like mirroring that. And that's something I'm always aware of. It's like I'm projecting my own upbringing, my own culture, my own biases, my own stereotypes, and being aware of that. And ultimately realizing through this kind of research and observation, I gain a better understanding of myself in relationship to other communities and to my family. And I think that kind of generational sort of understanding is sort of kind of the root of why I continue this book. This book had a very long gestation. It took, I don't even want to count the number of years. And there were moments where I wanted to give up because I felt like I was done. I'd finished the PhD. I was done. But I kept returning to it. And I think it's because the Vietnamese community and all communities are really so dynamic. And there have been a lot of interesting changes generationally, especially in the past 15 years. And so I returned to the book and that became more and more important to this, the kind of story I wanted to tell.
Hi, this is Kenneth Nguyen. A few years ago, before I launched the Vietnamese podcast, my father and all of his siblings passed away. Their passing marked the loss of their stories and the connection to my grandparents and great-grandparents. This is partly what inspired me to start the work of the podcast. Many of you still have the opportunity to record and preserve the legacies of your own families. I've just begun to sit with a few families now for interview sessions to record the rich histories of their parents and the lives of the generations that preceded them. Don't let your family's stories go untold. Take a moment to reach out to me, and together we will bring out your family's story on a recorded journey. I've included the link in the episode description. Visit VietnamStoryBank.com today for more information. I'm going to be straddling the fence between, you know, this conversation about the Korean American community, Korea and Korea, Vietnam, Vietnamese American, Vietnam and Viet. It's
I love it. Yeah, this is great.
Yeah. Obviously we'll sprinkle, you know, elements of architecture and, you know, how you got, I want to know the process of getting to all these little Saigons, you know, and so all of this conversation is very interesting to me. And so we'll nerd out. And I just wanted to warn the audience that we're going to be talking a lot about the parallels and the differences in Korea and Vietnam as it relates to the American diaspora communities of both Vietnam and Korea.
Yeah, absolutely.
So let's start with this idea of the process of getting to make contact with all of these little Saigon. You know, I imagine that there's these symbolic, you know, mayors of all these little Saigons, you know. Can you walk me through the process of the people, the research materials, the archive, city administration in each of these little Saigons? Not in each of them, but, you know,
I'll give you, I'll either scare everyone away from doing this kind of research or open myself up to criticism or inspire people to do it. So when I say this book had a long gestation, I started doing research in 2005.
Wow.
Yeah. And at that point, there was some scholarship about the Vietnamese American diaspora. There were, you know, authors, but a lot of the research was more in kind of demographics and sociology and surprisingly public health, mental health, sort of bridging from like resettlement. And there wasn't that much research about art and architecture. And So I saw an opportunity to contribute from my own research background, which is really in everyday landscapes, public art making, public spaces, and theme parks. So I have a particular interest in kind of commodified cultural landscapes, the way in which we sort of consume culture through shopping, through eating, and through the design of these sort of manufactured landscapes. So Chinatown or Alvera Street, like those things are part of my passion. And so starting this research, I kind of went in a bit naively. I just started looking at demographically, like where are large concentrations of Vietnamese? And it was really just about population. And then Google Map became my best friend of just like mapping out businesses and sort of identifying enclaves. And some of this work was supported by some of the academic research. And I basically identified about 12. 12 that I thought were worth visiting. And I really wanted to focus on more suburban and urban and less kind of rural communities. And that was a choice I made. And obviously, if it were more comprehensive, I would be really interested in these smaller towns where it's like this one little outpost, right? And then that becomes the center of the community. And so I rustled up some funds for traveling. And I would schedule these research trips, and it was really important to go to these places. So 2006, 2005, there weren't that many things that were digitized. So you really had to go to these places. And what happened was I would basically call all of the historical societies and the archives and say, hey, what do you have about, the Vietnamese community? And the answer was nothing. We have nothing. And these were like very kind of white Anglo historical societies, very traditional, right? It's kind of like a settler history. And that kind of made sense. And so I started to go to public libraries because they tend to have a regional sort of archive. And they tend to be newspaper clippings or community newspapers or photographs, just things they've collected. And so I'd spend a lot of time just sort of sifting through whatever the librarians had prepared. So I would do that in places like Portland, Seattle, LA, Houston, Boston, like Chicago. Most of these major cities have a pretty robust public library research system for like anyone can go in. You don't have to be a special academic researcher to go into these places. And so I was lucky to spend some time like Xeroxing, photocopying. I have huge banker's boxes filled with this material. But then there was this question of like identifying people to talk to. And so I didn't have a lot of contacts in the community. I was really outside of the community. My only contact into a community was actually through my parents, who are Catholic, who knew this Vietnamese priest who I could like talk to. And that was like, so, I think people who are doing oral histories, who are doing these kind of more anthropological, ethnographic studies, they are much more embedded. They have contacts within the community. There's a whole research methodology. That wasn't sort of my training. My training was to basically look at buildings, map out buildings, draw them, kind of study them and put them within a context that's architectural and urban. So I was kind of learning on the fly. And I think in hindsight, I would have done things differently. I would have gotten a different kind of training, like I would have sought those out. But I was just kind of trying to figure things out as I went along. And so the public libraries were a good source. And then there are a few local archives that happen to have papers that have been donated by some businessmen, usually. It's like Vietnamese, Chinese, Vietnamese refugee business people who had donated their papers. And so I went through those. That was in Chicago. Chicago is a great city for public history. Then I went to the grocery store and I grabbed the Vietnamese business directory and I went and talked to the people who are running these business directories because they kind of have a pulse on the community. I looked at real estate signs and I cold called developers and real estate agents saying, hey, do you want to talk to me? I found people's names in the local newspapers, artists, and I would call them. And it was not an easy thing because it's hard to kind of just call people and gain their trust. And I'm sure you can appreciate this, but most people are busy. They're working really hard. They don't have a ton of time to just sort of sit and chit chat about things. And so often when I have these interviews, it's sort of like, what do you want? Why are you talking to me? Like, what's your objective? Right. And they're sort of like sizing me up, trying to understand like why this person is interested. And often there was a moment in the conversation where they're like, why are you interested in this? This is not interesting. Right. There's nothing special or unique about what we're doing. This is just our lives, you know? And so I would talk a little bit more about why I thought it was interesting. And we kind of walked away from that conversation, hopefully having learned something from each other. There were some cases where I was talking to sort of the mayor, the mayor of a little Saigon. And I wanted to be careful about speaking to people who believe they speak for the community, because they tend to have probably the biggest kind of ulterior motive, right? Because they are kind of personally benefiting from the packaging and the promotion of the Little Saigon or the Chinatown or the Koreatown, right? And I think that's pretty much common if you study any ethnic enclave or any community. You always have to ask yourself, who is this person? Why are they promoting this thing, and how will they benefit, right? Often there was a lot of conflict even in Chinatowns where there was like the mayor of Chinatown, but they tended to represent the business class or a very kind of specific political ideology, and they wanted to speak for the entire community. And we know that each community is quite diverse across ethnicity, language, class, like their gender differences. There's so many differences. And so I didn't want to only rely on sort of kind of the gatekeepers of a community. I wanted to talk to just sort of everyday people about what was interesting to them or like why they were passionate about Little Saigon. That was really important. The funny thing, oh, and I will have to say the Southeast Asian American Archives in UC Irvine, that was like the only archive that was specifically dedicated to Vietnamese refugees, Southeast Asian refugees and immigrants. And that was sort of like the beginning. And so I spent a lot of time pulling out all of their files, digging through everything.
Who did you work with over there?
That was during Anne Frank's time. So she was kind of like the founding archivist librarian. And then it was Thuy Vo Deng who took over. And I'm not quite sure who is involved right now. I think there were a few personnel changes. But Anne Frank was the beginning of that at UCI. And it was incredibly important. And now there are Vietnamese American oral history projects. There are little cultural centers. There are artifacts. There's collections. The Smithsonian had a traveling exhibition of the Vietnamese American experience. In Virginia, there's a whole oral history project about Clarendon and sort of the origins of the enclave that then moved to Eden Center. So we're starting to see this kind of like sea change, this groundswell of material, archival material, research material that's being produced by the community itself. And I think that's so important.
Yeah, I have two things to say. The first 25 pages of your book goes into a lot of details about the history of the Vietnamese diaspora, and it is nothing to do with architecture or buildings. And it gives you it paints a really broad but also detailed picture of the history of the people and the numbers of the waves of Vietnamese that left Vietnam, and as it compares to other communities, such as in France, all over the world, and it gives you a really good snapshot. And I thought to myself, if somebody can explain all of this in the first 25 pages, you know, imagine what is going to unfold in the next 200 pages of this book as it relates to architecture and buildings, because, you know, really getting, you know, there are so many facts in that first 25 pages that I didn't know about. And, you know, when we, as the Vietnamese American audience of this podcast, gets a glimpse of what is, what has happened, it gives context to a lot of the things that that have rolled out in the world in the last 50 years of our history. So thank you so much for spelling that all out.
Like, don't thank me. Thank all the researchers who, that was me just kind of synthesizing,
yeah,
and trying to like tell a story that made sense. It was probably the hardest thing I wrote, to be honest. That sort of introductory, yeah, overview, because I was sort of like, which details should I include? Because there are entire books that go into all, mm-hmm, of this painstaking detail. But for me, as a historian, it's really important to have this like overview kind of timeline, so that when you know something was built or there was a protest at this particular moment, you kind of need to know what was happening in Vietnam, what was happening in the US, what was happening globally, and even what was happening like literally at City Hall in Westminster, and yeah, like all the political infighting. And so it's like moving between those scales, I think it's really important. And for me, like, I don't know that much about Korean history. Like, right, I'm gonna be honest. Like, I read books and I'm like, oh, I'm similar to you. I'm like, I didn't know that was happening. Like, that's, yeah, so fascinating, because it's sort of your lived experience. You're experiencing it, but I'm kind of looking at it as a historian.
Yeah.
And seeing, connecting dots.
Yeah. And the second thing I want to bring up was, you know, when you were telling me that in the beginning in 2005, 2006, you were trying to go to all of these public places, and I was like, why don't you just reach out to these community people? But there was none.
They were there, but they were not. It was different.
They were there, but I think institutionally, these, exactly, communities weren't existing in a way that exists today.
Exactly. And that's what I think is so heartening for me, to see the community, especially kind of bridge the generational divide from like first and second generation, and starting to have those conversations and collect those materials, the family photos, the history, all the ephemera, and then like building out an archive, collecting those stories. Because a lot of the, and I think this is true for almost any refugee diasporic community, is that the first generation is just so busy surviving.
Yeah.
They're hustling. Like, they're hustling really hard to survive. They're dealing with their own traumas, right? They're dealing with being homesick, losing a homeland, like all these things, and like dealing with these, you know, children who are difficult, who won't speak the language, and who are going off and like changing and not respecting the culture. And so the archival kind of impulse that I saw in 2005, 2006 was mostly around the Vietnam War. It was about anti-communism. It was about commemorating the veterans and really like solidifying this kind of anti-communist kind of political identity. And that's not what we're seeing anymore. I mean, it's still there, but now we're seeing this kind of interest and care for like the family stories and for what it means to be the rising generation and what it means to have a different relationship to Vietnam and a different relationship to America. And for me, that's really important, is that you're starting to see more voices talking about what kinds of stories, what kind of materials to preserve and to take care of and to create.
I mean, frankly, there was shame in second generation, probably Koreans as well, but in Vietnamese, there's a deep shame of being Vietnamese throughout the country. And I think this whole idea of Little Saigon was something we went with our parents to, but eventually we would all sort of not want to be around it or be associated with Little Saigon. And I speak from my own personal experience. And today, I want to give a shout out to a dear friend of mine. His name is Chris Tran, and he started this page called Little Saigon Official. And he's reclaimed the idea of Little Saigon as, you know, as a proud moment in our history. And he's made souvenirs. He's made, you know, a merchandise to reflect the pride of being a member of Little Saigon in Westminster. And he has a shop out in the Asian Garden Mall in Little Saigon here in California, in Orange County. And Chris is special because he's recognized that, you know, at one point we were full of shame, but now we are in a situation where economically we can reclaim this and make it sort of like the Eiffel Tower. We can make it as the pyramids of Cairo. We can make it a spotlight that, you know, visitors and travelers throughout the world come back to Little Saigon and the Asian Garden Mall and celebrate Little Saigon as an actual hub of Vietnamese American culture.
I'm glad you raised that, because this is something that I've been thinking a lot about, as sort of like, why study buildings? Why study urban design and memorials and monument making? And a part of it is that the first generation, they arrive and they're struggling, and then they start building up an enclave, sometimes for economic reasons, sometimes the political kind of reason is even stronger. And it's true that for the most part, you know, the younger generation is embarrassed. They are ashamed. They don't want to be in these spaces. And unfortunately, you know, the history of especially in North America, is that a lot of these enclaves, which developed for kind of self-preservation, community preservation and support, people start to leave. They move away, because that's kind of like the American dream, is that you buy the house in the suburbs and you move on. And you become, you know, the Chinatowns, like, a lot of them were destroyed or like really hollowed out. And even, you know, like Little Italy's, like a lot of these enclaves start to disappear. And some of them just gone immediately. Like there's like no real sign of them, like in Houston, like that's one example. And the thing is, if you give up your property, or you never own the property and you leave, then for the second generation, the third generation, what is being reclaimed, right? And place and property and kind of the ability to return to a place and make it your own, I think is really important. That's when we talk about this kind of like generational wealth and social capital, is that, you know, the immigrant story is about arriving and moving on.
Yeah. And becoming white and being integrated into white.
It's the assimilation.
Yeah.
And so I do think attachments, sentimental, nostalgic, whatever, are important. And being able to hold on to property is really important, because then the next generation can decide what to do with it. And this is a source of pretty significant conflict, I think, generationally, where a lot of the older generation who own these buildings, they see their legacy as selling the property, making millions of dollars and passing it on to their children. But a lot of the children, I think, would rather just have the property because they can do other things with it. Because can you imagine going back and now renting this thing that now costs like 10 times as much as what it cost in 1978?
Yeah.
So, but it's like, what does it mean to kind of have this area that is yours, that you've claimed, that you're kind of nurturing and maintaining over multiple generations? In the US, it's like, it's always been this history of change, transformation, and another community comes in and does things. And I don't think we should preserve, you know, like a perfect little snow globe, these enclaves, because then you end up with a Little Italy that there are no Italians there. There are no Italian businesses. It's just like a theme park. You go and you have Taste of Little Italy, but like all the businesses are not Italian anymore. And what does that mean, right? So there has to be room for natural change, but also you might want to hold on to things a little bit longer and just see what the next generation might want to do with it. And that's something that I had a long, very long, wonderful conversation with a former student and his mom who have a shop in Toronto's not Little Saigon. But about exactly those questions, you know, like, why is it so important to kind of maintain a presence?
You know, I'm going to butcher this, but Lionel Richie says at the end of this recent documentary called Greatest Night in Pop, it's on Netflix, directed by Vietnamese Bao Nguyen. And at the end of the documentary, it's about the We Are the World song, the making of it. And at the end of it, Lionel Richie's sitting in the studio that they recorded We Are the World, and he says that there's a quote from his father that said, you know, basically, one day when you're not in this home and the same people are not here, it'll be different. And what makes this special, what makes this room, what makes this recording studio special at one point was the presence of these 46 superstars that were in here recording that one night. And it's the same parallel when I think about Little Saigon, and I think about 100 years from now when the Vietnamese Americans have moved on and it becomes sort of this this park, this theme park of Little Saigon. And you see the, you know, the different motifs that the Vietnamese left behind. It'll be a sad day because at that point, you know, you can only imagine what it was like 100 years ago when it was a thriving street. Bosa was a thriving place where Vietnamese Americans were just everywhere. Every car you look left and right, it's basically an Asian person or a Vietnamese person in that corridor. It's fascinating.
I agree. And like, there is a bit of that, I think, not quite nostalgia, but like trying to recollect what it was like back then, you know, and as a historian trying to reconstruct it, even trying to describe it, like what it must have meant for people at that time to have that kind of community and that space. But I think a lot about Garden Grove, which has changed a lot. Every year I go back home, and my parents live in South Orange County now. They moved from Long Beach, and we still go to Garden Grove, but like not that much, not that often. When we go, I'm like, oh, is that a pho restaurant? Like, oh, is that a bit like, oh, and like things are in taco joint and like, oh, this is like, things are changing, right? It's super interesting because I'm actually seeing kind of the decline, the waning of Garden Grove's like kind of Korean business community. And if you follow the diaspora, you look at where are they moving? Fountain Valley, a little bit of San Gabriel Valley, Irvine, huge, huge presence, Tustin. And you see these new shopping centers popping up. And so they still want their creature comforts. They still want their grocery stores and their restaurants. And it's kind of like booming outside. Like it's cool. Like you go, there are huge lineups to go into like a Korean barbecue place. It's like in every strip mall. And a part of me is like, this is the fantasy. Like this is the dream come true. Like we're mainstream. Like I don't have to be embarrassed about being Korean. Like we are super mainstream. Like everywhere I look, it's Koreans, Vietnamese, Cambodians, Filipinos, like Latinos, Chicana, like everyone, Armenians, Iranians, like it's all of us. We're all here and we're just like eating each other's cuisine and like it's all cool and we're super happy. And a part of me is like, and we're just like living the suburban dream, I guess. And a part of me loves that. Because I love this idea that our children can grow up in a world, in a place where they're not made fun of for their names or the different smells in their house. Like you're not embarrassed about bringing people over because everyone's just like, it's cool, right? Like nobody cares. Everyone's interested in like going and trying each other's cuisine. Like they don't mind. Like, so part of me is like really excited about this minority majority world. But another part of me wonders, like, well, what do we gain and what do we lose? And I think part of that is inevitable, right? Like 100 years from now, it's like even going back to Korea with my parents, and my mom wanted to show me something, and she wanted to show us her old house where she grew up. And we got there, it was gone. And you could just see this moment of like, she had no idea. And that was like, but we still could go and we could still imagine, right? And so I wonder if that's what's going to happen in a lot of these little Saigons and Koreatowns. And I think for the most part, that is what's going to happen.
Well, I'll tell you what has happened in my lifetime, which is Chinatown in LA used to be the Vietnamese Chinese enclave before the 626. So growing up in the 80s, for me, I remember there was this one small restaurant that was always packed, and it was in an alley, and it was called Chu Chel Restaurant. And it was four sisters that worked with their parents in this little alley in this restaurant. And as people started to migrate east into the 626, San Gabriel Valley,
yeah,
there were these restaurants that popped up in Orange County and in the 626. And so the people at Chu Chow, that family went off and opened up Newport Seafood, which is the famous Newport Seafood that exists in San Gabriel Valley and Orange County. There's the Newport, it's called Tan Cang. And these were the sisters that grew up, and then they managed their own restaurants. And now you walk by there, the Chinatown Summer Nights, they have these big music festivals there, and it's not there. But I walk by it and I am haunted beautifully by the ghost of my father, my mother walking us in evenings where it was just a different sort of vibe that was happening. And just being brought back to when I was 7 years old, 6 years old, and we used to go to Chu Chow and eat at this restaurant, and everything moved to the east. And then Vietnamese people started migrating towards Little Saigon. And then now that push that you're talking about, like the jamboree, the Diamond Jamboree.
They keep moving.
And we're losing the beauty of the Olvera Street of our Chinatown. It's like a ghost town now when it's like regular hours on a weekday. But we now have, Irvine, and we now have these big, beautiful restaurants that are mainstream.
Yeah, they're mainstream, and it's like a different vibe. And I'm sure like our children they'll be haunted by the memories of standing in a parking lot, Diamond Jamboree, like waiting or going into H Mart and like picking up. I'm sure my kids already have those, like they're forming these memories. So like all the memories are like equally valid and important, but there's something about these like mom and pop, like kind of really rickety little tucked away spaces. And like, especially Vietnamese shopping centers, like what I have found, and I've always made this argument, and some people buy and some people don't, but I'm like, Vietnamese are different. Like they really are different in how they use space. And they're like, and other people say, oh, no, this is just like immigrants. This is just like traditional marketing. And I'm like, no, because every single little Saigon I go to, there was always an indoor mall that looks like a strip mall. Like it looks like a shopping center, like a regular parking lot, L-shaped shopping center. There's always this thing, but then there's a door and it says entrance. And you walk in and it's like this really, sometimes it's like a really dark, narrow hallway, double corridor with these tiny little shops, these little booths. And you would have no idea that it existed if you were just in the parking lot. You would just think like, oh, here are all the shops.
I want to break this down. This is interesting. So I didn't know that. I never thought about that. You're right.
It's weird. It's weird.
But it's in Vietnam. This is
exactly.
Have you been to Vietnam?
Yes.
So this is a thing. This is a thing in Vietnam. But I think the history of our outdoor markets were, this is something I just recently learned, and maybe I'm wrong, but what I've learned is, so we've had traditionally outdoor markets, but when the French came in, they consolidated these outdoor markets and they put them into concrete structures. And then they put booths in it. So
that's
you could
right.
walk through all of these markets. So it's like the French history, the French architecture brought this sort of organization to Vietnam. And then the merchants and the business class brought this sort of like this structure to America. And now
exactly.
that you bring it up, I've never thought about that.
It's like almost all cultures have indoor and outdoor markets and little stalls and petty traders and like shop houses. Like this is not like the Western modern kind of shopping mall, right? And you tend to have like the jewelry street and this kind of like all the streets are specialized. It's very medieval in a way, right? Like you have like your trade guild system, but the Vietnamese in particular, for many interesting reasons, this was like a really viable economic model and a social model for them because everyone's kind of hustling. Obviously, there's some barriers to mainstream employment as a refugee, as a newcomer, right? And so you could open a little shop in the mini mall if the booth, like the stall, is tiny, like it's affordable. It's like when you go to the mall and there are the little kiosks.
Yeah.
I mean, you rent them and they are actually kind of expensive. But anyways, but it's this idea of it's like a little business incubator. And it did also, so economically, it made sense. It was an affordable way to kind of have a business. But also socially, it made sense because it kind of brought a bit of home and sort of the sights and the sounds. And it created what I talk about, especially with like places like Eden Center, you know, this kind of like retrofitted mall with like this interior shops. It created this kind of a safe haven where you could kind of just do your business. You could do whatever you wanted in there. And you were sort of shielded from the public view. And it was air conditioned and like, you have these guys who are like sitting, maybe, you know, doing a little gambling, a little card playing, just sitting, chatting, drinking their coffee. You know, you have people just doing stuff, but they're kind of sheltered from view and they can kind of just be who they are without worrying, right? That, you know, some cop is going to come by and say, like, what are you doing? Right? It's sort of like you're kind of protected. And I think that's really important for diasporic communities and refugees and newcomers is that you want a place where you don't have to explain yourself. You want a place where you feel comfortable, right? You want a place where you're accepted and you feel completely at home. We talk about it as sort of like a third space. It's not home and it's not this institution. It's this other third space where you're incredibly comfortable, right? And I think the design of a lot of these little Saigons, including these indoor malls, these sort of like swap meet type environments, it was a way of bringing that feeling of home, but also had very pragmatic reasons.
Right. This episode is brought to you by Red Boat Fish Sauce. I love cooking with Red Boat because it's made with only two ingredients, wild caught anchovies and sea salt. This premium fish sauce is made in Phu Quoc, Vietnam, and bottled right here in California. You can find Red Boat at select Asian supermarkets like 99 Ranch, H Mart, and Tong Phat.
Yeah, like super pragmatic.
What are the, you know, I often think about when I look at the little Saigons that I've been to all over the country, what are the differences? What are the exact sort of like details that really say and scream, this is Vietnamese?
So I would say the little mini mall kind of flea market feeling is very Vietnamese for me. Even if you're like, you know, on Canal Street in New York, like in a Chinatown, and you see like a little indoor subdivided kind of shop stall situation, my radar immediately starts pinging. I'm like, Vietnamese, Vietnamese. And I start looking around like, yep, Vietnamese, that's Vietnamese. So that's like, for me, a dead giveaway. This isn't to say that other Asian diasporic communities don't have these kind of like indoor things. Like they tend to be like more food court oriented. Like in Koreatown, you'll see like a grocery store with a huge food court and a few stalls with like bedding and makeup and whatever. It's also common as well. But this kind of like little corridor with the little shops, to me, that's very Vietnamese. If I see a lot of plants in the shop window, I'm like, Vietnamese, like that's very Vietnamese. So just like fill your shop window with like everyone's got like little shrines and like incense and like there are different things that happen. But when I see like tons of plants, then I think that might be Vietnamese. That's kind of like pretty much it for like the sort of everyday interventions. The other kinds of interventions, sort of architectural and urban expressions that I see that are very distinctly Vietnamese are much more, it's like more kind of the symbolic architecture. So that's when you start to see, and I talk about kind of the conflicts around the naming of a district, but also the materials, the colors. Like Little Saigon in Westminster is unprecedented in having design guidelines
Oh, really?
that specify the kind of architecture that they prefer for the Little Saigon district.
Can you name a few of those things?
Oh yeah, for sure. And this was built out, this was developed in the 90s, and they've maintained it as their design guidelines. So things that they recommend, they don't want generic kind of stucco plate glass modern shopping centers. They have to be themed as either what they call kind of Chinese. So having like the tiled roof and the flared eaves, or French colonial.
Wow, I had no
Yeah.
idea this was in the books.
And they've kept it. They've kept
Man,
it.
you see a lot of it. You see, it's very it's ubiquitous in Little Saigon.
But in the beginning, on Bolsa, those were just like 1950s shopping centers. And some of them were in kind of that old English, Tudor English style. And the Vietnamese and Chinese Vietnamese entrepreneurs and building owners, they just kept it as is. You know, they didn't make any changes, right? Because it's like, that's a waste of money. Like, why would you spend money changing the design of your shopping center? It's good enough, right? Like very pragmatic people, right? You're just like, why would I do it? But you started to see some of the kind of major developers in Little Saigon who wanted to differentiate their projects from other projects. And so they started to do like the ornamental gate, and they started to bring in the tiles, and it was very Chinatown architecture, like almost indistinguishable, right? And that was kind of like the first wave of symbolic architecture in Little Saigon, where you kind of go there and you're like, I don't know, this looks like Chinatown to me. And sometime around the 90s, there's this sort of switch over, like this conscious, like the development of a distinctly Little Saigon architecture to differentiate it from Chinatown or Koreatown or Japantown, Little Tokyo. So like Chinatown would have, you know, maybe it's green tiled roof or the red tiled roof and the flared eaves and a lot of dragons, a lot of lion dogs, things like that. Pagoda towers. Koreatown, well, Koreatown's not really themed, but Japantown tends to have the blue glazed tile roofs. And so the Japanese, the Vietnamese was sort of like, are we Chinese? It's complicated because of the Chinese influence and presence and occasionally kind of control over the Vietnamese kingdoms, right? So it's like there's a lot of mixing and there's a large ethnic Chinese population within Vietnam. So it's sort of like, is it Vietnamese? Is it Chinese? Is it just Asian? But there are some differences. So one, you'll often see this kind of like this yellow. So like a building painted this sort of yellow color. It's also very common in Vietnam, and you've probably seen some of these buildings that are painted yellow. And
They're
that is different.
everywhere.
They're different, right? So seeing that color immediately, you're like, aha, Vietnamese, right? And then when you start to see the colonial influence, you're like, oh, this is different. Like, you wouldn't see this kind of French colonial architecture in a Chinatown. You would never see it, even though the French were around, you know, and they were getting in everyone's business, right? All over Asia. But like, suddenly this new identity emerged, which was like really kind of sort of a Chinese influence or a French colonial influence, which is really interesting if you think about the history of Vietnam.
I have recently reconciled my feelings about this whole thing.
Tell me about it.
I've had architects on the show before to talk about this. You know, what is really Vietnamese if we are preserving French colonial buildings in Saigon and Hanoi, right? This is a thing that we do. We love it. And I began to kind of really explore this question of like our relationship to the French, because they were really, you know, colonial powers that, you know, killed and took over, you know, our cities. But at the same time, there's this sort of love for French culture. And, you know, I've talked to the previous generations about their feelings about the French. And for the most part, the French are beloved. The French are beloved to the previous generation because of the introduction of this idea of literacy and making literacy easier for our people, the introduction of baguettes and the introduction of like Western sort of foods from France. And it didn't seem like that they had issues, their grandparents, my parents' parents' parents didn't have issues being sort of taken out from whatever impoverished situation they were in to be elevated. And a lot of them, a lot of the leaders in the Vietnamese, in Vietnam at the time, were being paid a lot of money to be, you know, a French minion. And it really helped many generations of Vietnamese people. And I think that the previous generation looks fondly on the French culture coming into Vietnam as a something that was better for society. And this conversation is very nuanced, because it's not none of this stuff's up there black and white. But I'm beginning to learn that unlike the Japanese or unlike the Chinese, the feelings, that the sentiments that the Vietnamese have towards the Japanese and Chinese, it's not the same with the French. It's very different. And I think that incorporating this French colonial architecture in Little Saigon in America is sort of a natural kind of fun thing that's, you know, they take pride in. Vietnamese community takes pride in that kind of that French tapestry.
It's complicated, right? It's super, super complicated. And like, I think the cynical part of me is like, oh, this is just marketing, right? This is just a way of catering to people outside of the community, right? And I talk about this a bit in my chapter about the urban design history of Westminster's Little Saigon and how it's sort of like a calculated move to kind of differentiate. Because when you're driving through Southern California and you see these colonial, French colonial, you're just like,
whoa,
that's weird, because you're so inundated with either Chinatown style buildings or this kind of Spanish colonial Mediterranean Italian Tuscan weird architecture, right? And that's kind of like the vernacular. And suddenly you see this like French colonial building, you're like, that's different. So there's that kind of cynical aspect, but there is also, I think, this kind of conscious claiming of a problematic history and sort of maybe making peace, but also taking advantage of it and sort of creating your own identity. And I think
I would actually argue that a lot of these people don't think of it as problematic. My mother doesn't think of it.
Yeah, probably, you know, your mom doesn't.
You and I were sitting on the outside as analysts. You know, we're sitting and we're going, wait, this is problematic when a foreign country comes in and invades another country. But there's a lot of people in my mother and her previous generations that don't view this relationship any bit problematic.
That's fair. That's fair.
They view it, and I think that I was having a hard time with my Catholic identity because before the French came in, we were Buddhist and we were,
That's right.
We worshiped our parents. And so I had a big problem with having to like convert and like deal with this stress of being a Vietnamese American Catholic. It just doesn't make any sense. Why do I have to be forced to worship a deity that was introduced much later? Right.
Same Korean Catholic, yeah. Right? Same issue. But I think it's appropriation, cultural appropriation is now a bit of a dirty word. But when I was sort of going through college, it was actually considered a really powerful thing to reclaim and make your own something that had been used to control you. And so I don't usually use the word appropriation, but there is this interesting kind of like hybridization and sort of stock taking. And I talk a lot about how the symbolic architecture is used both, it's kind of like this, what if the South Vietnamese had won the war? What if, there are all these like what ifs kind of floating around. What if we didn't have to leave? What if, hundreds of thousands of people didn't perish, in the ocean or languish in refugee camps? Like what if, this had happened, right? What would Saigon, Ho Chi Minh City, what would Saigon be? What would it be like? What would the relate, like what kind of architecture, what kind of spaces? And I think bringing some of that French colonial architecture to the United States, there's a bit of nostalgia, but there's also this kind of pride in this sort of cosmopolitan, sort of sophisticated, global kind of identity.
For sure. Right?
And that feels like it's very powerful in a way to sort of own that history and sort of claim it as your own, as like the little site. At one, like my book was always called Building Saigon. And then my editor was like, should call it Building Little Saigon because that's confusing. And I was like, but in my mind, and I'm like, I'm sorry to my editors, but like in my mind, it really is Building Saigon. It's this Saigon is no more. And Saigon is being built now on American soil or on other soil. And so for me, it was like, it's not a little, it is the Saigon.
Yeah.
And I understand that's confusing. And maybe it's like a stretch for me to say those things. But like, I consider the construction and development of Little Saigons to be a really powerful move.
I agree with you. But going back to this whole idea of loving French culture and not seeing it the way the second generation diaspora sees it. And I'm sure there's plenty of thinkers in the Vietnamese sort of in the 50s and the 40s thinking about reclaiming literally the land of Vietnam from the French. But at the same time, there's this sort of romantic, nostalgic feeling that Vietnamese diaspora after 75 feel. I mean, Paris by night.
Exactly. Can you get more?
You can't get more on the nose, right? It's just the love, there's a famous singer that just died last week. She was 80 and I forget her name. There's a big French singer that a lot of people grew up with. And I literally saw about 10 of my Facebook friends posting the death of this French singer. She was 80 and I could tell these people were in their 50s and 60s, how it affected their youth when they were growing up in Vietnam as teenagers or just when they were coming up like 8-year-old, 10-year-old kids and it was being played in the house. This singer must have been a huge name in these households that were educated, French educated, they spoke French, they went to French schools. And it seemed like a very, it was just like their Taylor Swift of their time,
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think that sort of the nostalgia is really important. And I think now seeing it kind of transfer to the next generation, it'll be interesting to see how the next generation, not even our generation, but the younger generation, what their relationship will be to this very complex kind of tapestry culture, and what they will appropriate or invent or transform as we move forward. Even in Chinatowns, I think it's super interesting to have a lot of American-born, Canadian-born Chinese who are looking at that sort of the kitschy Chinatown architecture, and they're running with it.
Yeah.
Right? They are making
totally.
The neon cats and the neon lion dogs and like all this stuff. But like all of that kind of kitschy architecture was developed 100 years ago as self-preservation, because the Chinese merchants, the Chinatowns, needed to market themselves as a tourist destination. And so they played up, amplified all the stereotypes for a Western white audience. And so there was shame, I think, for the later generations. Like, they didn't want to be seen as this kind of theme park Chinese person. And now we see a return and a reinterpretation, which I think is really important.
Celebration. Now,
exactly.
Can you tell me about some of the people that stood out to you in the interviewing process of the book?
Oh, man. I mean, I think like some of the people who really stuck out to me were not even Vietnamese, because like I talked to this man, Joe Hurdle, who was in Chicago, and he was a Vietnam vet, and he was working for the city, and he discovered this whole like Vietnamese enclave on the north side of Chicago. And he was really drawn, he was like transported to this place. And so he was creating this kind of like storefront, like memorabilia museum, where he was just collecting Vietnam War artifacts. And, like there are all these like the army supply stores, where you can buy like whatever stuff. So he was like, he had like a little space, and he started moving closer and closer to his Vietnamese community, and then opened a little museum. It was a museum. Nothing was for sale, but it was almost like a shrine. And he befriended a lot of the Vietnamese refugee business owners, and he collected materials from them to display in this museum. And then he would donate some of the materials back into their restaurants and shops. And it became this like interesting community hub where American vets and Vietnamese refugees and veterans kind of, they could interface with each other in a different way. They're both communities that are in the U.S. and they're kind of tied by the war, but they also feel a lot of shame and a lot of grief about what happened. And you have to kind of imagine, after the American vets came back, like they were really ostracized as well. Like, it was seen as like they were losers or baby killers or like all these things. And they were, they were suffering so much, as well as the refugees. And this museum was, it was literally like he had like English language courses. It was a community donation drop-off center, so people could drop off supplies and then they would be redistributed out into the Chicago community. And it was like this really important space. And every time I talked to him, he was like, why are you interested in this? Like, it was just this thing I did, and nobody was really interested in giving us money or preserving it. And so I eventually just closed up because I'm getting old, I'm moving on. Right. And for me, it was like kind of heartbreaking, because it was like, and now it's gone, right? There's no, it doesn't even have a website anymore. Like, I found him through his website, because the store was already, the museum was already gone. And he sent me all this material, and we had like the back and forth conversations. And like, he just, for him, it was like a thing he did, and then he moved on. But for me, I was like, it's really important to kind of share this story. And I think that kind of pragmatism in a lot of what happens with the Little Saigons, it's like a common refrain, right? I talked to a developer in Houston, Panlo No Tran Park, and, she was redeveloping some malls, but like they were very mainstream. And I said, oh, this building's going to be torn down. That was like the center of the Midtown Little Saigon. She was like,
well,
like, this is what happens. The community has moved. They've moved down Bel Air, they're gone, right? And she's like, the best we can do is like maybe put up a sign, a memorial plaque, a heritage plaza, but like we have to be realistic. And so a lot of these conversations were kind of around that. But then towards the end of writing the book, I had a few interviews with a former student who is Vietnamese Canadian, Phat Le, and his his mom, Min Nguyen, and she owns this convenience store in Toronto. And honestly, having interviews with both of them together was so amazing, because it was almost like I was just watching them talk to each other. And they have like completely like similar yet different experiences and attitudes about what it means to be Vietnamese in Toronto, to arrive in this place, to grow up in this place that's now gentrifying. And so there's this moment where like that was talking about how he was a bit bitter. He was like a little bit annoyed because he, I don't know, sorry, that's male. He felt annoyed that Vietnamese food is hot. Everybody is into Vietnamese food now. Like everyone's like all like second generation, they're opening up these like really cool pho restaurants, and like it's all confusion and interesting. And he was like, oh, so now my food is cool. Like, because you know, there's some trauma of growing up and being made fun of for your food, like the food that your mom packs you for lunch, and yeah. Everyone's like, what is that? And his mom is sitting there and she's like, I love it when my white customers come and ask me for food recommendations. And you could see them kind of looking at each other. And I was like, this is really amazing. This is really important. Like, this is part of the work of being part of the diaspora and talking across the generation and trying to understand like why maybe your mom loves French colonial culture and why you might feel a little bit distanced. We need to have those conversations. Like all of us need to have those conversations. That's really important. So that's like, to me, having those interviews towards the end of the book, I was like, man, if I could go back, I would just write a book of this. Like, this is so important. Like, and people are doing it. And that's what makes me so happy, is that I know within the various communities, they are starting to have those interviews and they're collecting those histories. And I think that's super important for bridging that generational divide and carrying the community's heritage forward.
You know, the main reason I started the podcast was the tremendous amount of shame that I carry. And through dialogue and through interviews and through talking with people in the community, I have lifted parts of the shame aspect of my identity. But now, after like talking to you several minutes ago, I just realized something, that this is so special that we are living through this period in time where we could see the physical representation of the Vietnamese American diaspora in Little Saigon on Bosa. And that in a few short years, it's inevitable that these things will be torn down and the amount of Vietnamese Americans driving through that corridor will dwindle to a point where you'll see modern buildings that have no symbolic representations, because Vietnamese Americans will move on. They will move to bigger, brighter places. And it's just an inevitable fact of history. And it could become like Little Sicily or Little Italy of San Francisco, where there's just the ghost of its former self. And I just realized this in this conversation with you, that I really hope that the audience and the listener will go through Little Saigon, wherever you are in the world, and cherish the fact that we have this in our lifetime right now.
Absolutely. I mean, I think, again, it's like that was so important for me writing the book, is that these are sort of overlooked, or, you know, you take it for granted that these places exist and you don't really question how they came to be. And you don't even realize that they will very likely disappear in your lifetime in the next 10, 15 years. And that's just kind of what happens. And the ones that stay and grow bigger, there are like clear political and economic reasons why they get bigger and bigger. And that's something I talk about, Houston versus Westminster, the political, well, I mean, you just look at city council. Like Vietnamese Americans have taken on positions of political power and decision-making. And that's part of the reason why Little Saigon has grown the way it has. Whereas a lot of the other Little Saigons are, it's up and down for them.
Erica, can you sort of open up this conversation, this comparison between Little Saigon, Orange County, and Houston. Because you outline in this book, you dedicate chapters on the difference of these two communities.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so both cities have some of the largest Vietnamese population. San Jose would be another one. And they both started off in very similar ways. So like the resettlement history, very similar, kind of like downtown area, cheap housing, kind of dilapidated. Usually there's like a Catholic church involved somewhere, you know, kind of shepherding them and sort of making sure the social services happen. And you see all these shops opening, and in the 80s, it's so vibrant. Right. It's like you've got the little mini malls and like there's music blasting everywhere and like the sidewalks are filled with people chatting. All this stuff is happening. It's beautiful. It's wonderful. And then the two stories diverged. And basically what happens in Houston is that the area starts to be identified for gentrification, for redevelopment, because of the ambitions of the city at large. And you do have some sort of, you have a few Vietnamese developers, business owners who are powerful, and they're kind of part of the planning decision-making process. But how do I say this nicely? The general kind of MO of Houston is not really to celebrate ethnic diversity.
The Vietnamese community or the
all of them, like the white kind of, we call them like the power brokers.
Interesting. It's interesting.
Like it's incredible. Like Houston, like metropolitan Houston is incredibly diverse.
Yeah.
And it has like a historically really significant black communities, like the Fourth Ward, like really architecturally, culturally so important, but incredibly disinvested, impoverished, really, you know, discriminated against. And Houston has done very little to take care of the various cultural heritage landscapes in the city. They've allowed things to just kind of get bulldozed or to disintegrate, and they put very little effort into it. So it's not just like against the Vietnamese, it's like everyone is kind of, you know, any efforts that they bring forward to City Hall, there's like a lot of pushback or indifference, right? And I think you see that across most American cities, unfortunately. Like it's just, it's a fact. You see in Virginia, you see it everywhere. So Vietnamese, like a lot of refugees and immigrants, are incredibly practical. And so if they meet resistance, they just find a different way. And so they just followed the stream of ethnic minorities, right? Immigrants who are moving out to the suburbs where rent is cheap, development potential is huge. And they started building these huge mini malls, shopping centers down Bel Air. And so they just kind of left. They just like walked away from it, right? And it was weird because at one point they even convinced the Midtown district to put up Vietnamese language signs for different people, like commemorative signs, right? So they were trying to brand the area as a Little Saigon. And it's kind of officially known as a Little Saigon, but it's not really. And they put up this Vietnamese cultural heritage pavilion in a park. But for the most part, they've left. And they moved out to this kind of suburban condition, which is like, it's kind of like the San Gabriel Valley. It's like shopping center after shopping center after shopping center. But you start to notice it's like more Latino, Hispanic, then it becomes more Chinese. And then you're like, now it's becoming really Vietnamese. So even within this like endless strip, you notice differences. And so the Vietnamese who have moved out to Bel Air have tried in different ways to designate their section as a Little Saigon. And they've met a lot of political resistance and local resistance. Like, hey, it's not fair. Why do you get to differentiate your stretch of Bel Air from someone else's stretch of Bel Air? Why are you singling out Vietnamese versus just Asian town or just multicultural town, like whatever you want to call it? So there's been just a lot of pushback. And there are politicians who are Vietnamese American, like Hubert Vo, who's a state representative. He has a shopping center and he installed these memorials to South Vietnamese veterans, a boat people memorial, like an immigration memorial, like his shopping center kind of acts like a hub. But to actually like really build out this area as Little Saigon, there's been so much resistance. And that's not the case for Little Saigon and Westminster, where there was similar resistance and a lot of racism in Westminster, as we know, a lot of resistance to the signage, a lot of resistance to everything. But for different reasons, alliances have been forged, and they started to be forged pretty early on. And it's a complicated story, but basically, more Vietnamese Americans have gained political power as well as economic power, and they've managed to kind of insert their interests, their concerns into the city hall agenda.
You know, I know several of the mayors in those areas are married to Vietnamese women, and several of you know, a lot of politicians in that area are Vietnamese. And I think you swing the pendulum when you take part in the political process. And I think it was very pointed. I think it was a very concerted effort by the Vietnamese in, but I think it's more concentrated too.
It is. It's much more
concentrated.
Exactly.
In Garden Grove, Westminster,
exactly.
Mountain Valley.
It makes a huge difference. Yeah.
So they can
now, because even San Jose, it's still spread. Pretty spread out, right?
It's very spread,
so
yeah.
That kind of closeness is really important. So like the spatial kind of consolidation,
yeah.
And then the political consolidation,
huge,
is really important. And also Californians just love to theme everything. Like we just, the more we brand a neighborhood, like we love it. Like that's just, it's so, it's also a cultural thing. It's like for
cultural,
us, it's very
yeah.
Normal. Yeah,
and
we love doing it.
If you're in the state of Texas, I think there's a different type of pride.
Exactly.
That's more mainstream American.
Yep. Enough said. But there is like an incredibly rich, you know, Texan, Vietnamese, Gulf state, Vietnamese identity,
Big
right?
Time.
And like the cuisine is different. Like everything is different. And they're very proud of it.
Very
too.
Proud of it.
And
yeah.
I have a lot of Vietnamese friends, Vietnamese American friends who live in Texas. And so, but it's the city politics and the planning politics are just different. And the scale of Houston and Texas is just different. Absolutely.
Do you think that there will ever be this phenomenon of Little Saigons happening in other cultures, such as, you know, when Kabul fell a few years ago, you know, you would think that the people that left Afghanistan would come to the U.S. and one day form their little, you know, little Kabul somewhere, or, you know, Ukraine's probably going to go through some, you know, some manifestation of what we went through. And
yeah,
do you think that it's possible that any, you know, culture that comes to America from here into the future of the United States will ever set up shop the way Little Saigons across America have set up shop.
I think so. I think what they build will be very similar to most of the like Little Saigon Vietnam towns, or, you know, like the Little Italy's, like Little Ethiopia, like all of these kind of immigrant enclaves. They will form because out of necessity, out of mutual support, right? Like there's safety in numbers and it reminds you of home. And that's how information is shared and that's how wealth is grown. It's really important. But do I think that we'll have like a Little Havana, we'll have the Little Saigon that's kind of like the shining star, like sort of the cultural symbol? I'm going to go out on a limb and say no.
Yeah.
Like there might be one, but you won't have like the Chinatown phenomenon was unique.
Right.
And it was unique because of the Exclusion Act and because like the population was kind of frozen for like, you know, 50, 60 years. So there was very little change. So like no one was coming in, no one was really going out. And so they just had to consolidate. And there was so much discrimination. There's still discrimination, obviously, but there's a bit more social mobility. There's a more ability to like move and change, you know, where you live and how you work and what you do. I think every kind of diaspora needs at least one place that is kind of in the geographical imagination, and one place that in their mind is like, that's the center, that's the heart of the diaspora. Everyone needs it.
But I think
How
there's
big it
a,
will
yeah,
be,
that's what
who
I'm talking
knows?
about. There's a population sort of factor here. There's a
Yeah.
formula to the ratio of how many people were able to leave Kabul
That's
or
right.
how many people are going to be let in from Ukraine if this doesn't work out. And I think the numbers that you bring out in the first 20 pages of your book really puts a spotlight on the sort of power of the numbers that came out of Vietnam and that
Yeah.
lived and integrated into these little Saigon towns.
It's huge. It's huge. The
Massive
numbers are
numbers.
huge.
Massive
The
numbers.
numbers are absolutely huge. And it's like, I would say it's going to end up being like one tiny little Ukraine, like, you know, sort of like the Pilsen of Chicago. And that might be it. And it may not be super important to have it except as kind of a symbol. But like, I think that, like, honestly, I think that era in global history of those huge numbers of refugees and immigrants, I think it's over.
Yeah.
And a lot of it has to do with just national policies, right? There's been kind of a change, and a lot of people are kind of just trapped in refugee camps, for example, right? So I think we're just not going to see the same numbers. Like, it's shocking to think like 6 million people are being displaced here or there. Like, you think about the Sudan, you think about, you know, the Congo, you think about Ukraine, you think about all these conflict places in the world. You think about, you know, Gaza, you think about millions of people potentially. But where are they going? They're kind of unfortunately in limbo, right? And there was this weird moment during the Cold War where it was like American policy to like bring the people over. It's like, these are our people that like we're responsible for them. We're going to resettle them. We're going to sort it out. And it's changed. So I don't know what's going to happen next, but I imagine there might be like little pockets of the diaspora that will become kind of locally important and within the diaspora, but might not even be a blip on my radar or your radar because
Yeah.
we're not part of the
Part of the
community.
community. Yeah.
Yeah. But it's still important to have, I guess. Yeah.
Erica, how do we get a hold of your book?
I was like, Google it. So the University of Texas Press has a bookstore online. And so if you just Google Building Little Saigon, it'll pop up there. So it's easy to just order it from U of T Press, University of Texas Press. I've seen it pop up in like, I'm in Canada, obviously. So I know the University of British Columbia bookstore has they're listing it, so you can order it there as well. So that's probably the easiest way. And I believe they're running a sale right now. So
Yeah, why do you think this is? I mean, it's obvious, but I got to ask you, why is it important for Vietnamese American second generation, third generation to pick up this book and read it?
I think it's important to read this book because I know it's like, it's kind of weird. It's like, say, you should read this book because, but I think it offers historical context and framing of places that a lot of Vietnamese Americans take for granted right now, but might feel really passionate about in 10 or 15
Yeah.
years when things might disappear. And this book is not meant to sort of, you know, rally the troops and say like, do this, do that. But I think there needs to be this kind of appreciation for what the previous generation has built, that we may have some complicated feelings about for various reasons. And this book is sort of intended to shed light on some of the reasons, the rationale for why different Little Saigons developed the way they did, and why there are these like random statues and parking lots and like all this stuff is happening, like trying to build some context for it. I personally would love to have a book like this for myself that not only talks about, you know, the community's history of arrival, resettlement, building, maybe acculturation, integration, assimilation, resistance, like all those things that are happening, but also engages with architectural and urban design history at large. Because that was something that was really important to me, is like, we're not just studying the enclave as an enclave, as this like special separate thing. This is America. And I think it's wrong for American architectural historians to only talk about sort of American things as if it's like this is American, but this is like niche. It's like Chinatown and then, or Little Saigon and then everything else. It's like, no, actually, this is as much integrated and woven into American identity and American history as everything else. And so I needed to like keep mentioning, like, this isn't just happening in Little Saigon. Like, this phenomenon, this kind of interest in design is also all over the US. It's in this moment in the 90s, in postmodernism, this is what's happening. So that it kind of it frames everything for people so that they understand both the specialness of their history and their culture, but they can also see how their culture is also transforming what we call sort of mainstream America. And it's like this kind of two-way street. Like, there's a lot of exchange that is happening that is, I think, is so important, especially if you're the younger generation. You're already kind of in multiple worlds at the same time. And so this is a way to kind of connect the dots for people. And hopefully, you know, I would love for people to read this book and then go out and like build more archives, build more research material, or even just talk to their parents and their grandparents, like, and to go to the mall and like look at it differently and ask parents about what it means for them. I think it's sort of like a point of entry for people. And I think that's really important. And I would love to see city planners and architects and other people look at this book and try to appreciate these sort of humble everyday spaces as worth, you know, not necessarily preserving, but supporting if they want to be supported. And not just have this like inevitable story of like gentrification and like, oh, they've moved on. It's like maybe they do want to stay and maybe they don't want to be a theme park, right? So what does it look like to have this kind of community cultural anchor?
One last question. This is for fun, and this is going to be gross generalities.
Oh
What are the similarities and the differences of the Korean diaspora and the Vietnamese diasporas?
no.
I know it's an unfair question, but I just, for shits and giggles, from where you sit, I'd love to hear your observation
Oh man, oh man.
without getting into any hot water.
Oh my goodness. I would say there are a lot of similarities in the sense that you have very hardworking, very educated people who had to come to a place with very little means and really work from the ground up. And so I would say my generation, our generation, our upbringing, there's a lot of similarities, I would say. I don't know. Like, am I making gross generalizations? I feel like Korean Americans don't have a ton of pride.
Oh, interesting. That's
Like,
a
or maybe that's just
very,
me. Maybe that's just me projecting
yeah,
my own like
that's a very,
psychological hangups. But
very
like,
interesting.
for me, I don't know. Like, maybe you could say it differently. But for me, my Korean self and my American white assimilated self were like two different selves. Like, they're very separate. During the week, I went to this Catholic school and like I wore my little plaid uniform and like I tried to be very not Korean. And then I'd go to Garden Grove and it was like, this is Koreatown. This is like, these are the Koreans. And I didn't really understand it, and I didn't really like it, and I was really embarrassed by it. So maybe that's something we have in common. This is kind of like embarrassment over it. But like, I had a hard time understanding what it meant to be Korean.
You know, I don't hear much, and this is just my sort of like own experiences hanging out with my Korean American friends. There's not as much chest beating and chest thumping as we do in
Maybe
the
that's what I'm trying to say in like a less
Yeah.
offensive way. Like
There's not a lot of that compared, and but I don't know if it's actually linked to how much pride one culture has. You know, compared to another, I just don't think that it's, you know, I think the Korean culture that I've experienced in America is much more focused on just doing the work and
Yeah.
getting ahead and doing the work, and identity be damned, and it's not as important as the Vietnamese American identity. And I don't know what that is. I don't know if that has to do with like trying to cleanse our name of the war. And, you know, we're so close to it. You guys are what? You guys are much further away from the Korean War.
Totally. That's like there's a whole kind of generation of sort of reconstruction after the war, and then you start to see more Koreans leaving, right? And interestingly enough, I was having a conversation with my mom about this, and we were talking about, because I wasn't aware of it, she said there were a lot of Koreans who fought in the Vietnam War, in the
Lots.
war for the Americans. And she said that's how we grew our wealth, because the US government was giving money to the Korean government, and part of it, this like aid, part of it was like this kind of deal to like pay soldiers, basically as mercenaries, really, to go and do the dirty business of fighting. And they would send back dollars. My mom always said, the dollar is king. And so you come back with all this money and you reinvest it. And so in many ways, like our fates are
Intertwined.
entwined,
And
right?
you know, in District 7 in Vietnam right now, it's like basically Garden Grove. It's
Exactly, which is crazy.
so many Koreans, and there's a signage in sometimes it's only in Korean. It's
I
crazy.
know it is. It's super, super interesting. But I think the war is like a really crystallizing thing for one's identity, because you're so close to it. And, you know, some of the slightly older generation like have more memories of the end of the war and passage to traveling to the US or going through camps and things like that. For my parents, like it was, they really kind of positioned themselves as like economic immigrants, right? Like, we're leaving Korea because economically it doesn't seem great, so we're going to move to America and start over. And it's like the identity was just sort of like, keep your head down, keep working, keep working, keep working. And I think for Vietnamese of the same generation, there's this like huge trauma, right? And the loss of a homeland, right? And knowing you really can't return, and knowing all those connections have been severed, and that really like then shapes the next generation's identity. But we'll see what happens with the next generations. It keeps changing.
Does. Erica, thank you so much. I always value outside opinion when it comes to the, you know, for right or for wrong, for better or for worse, just valuing the time that somebody like you put into studying our history is such a beautiful thing. So thank you so much for coming on the podcast and doing the work that you've done.
Thank you, Kenneth, for inviting me. And honestly, I love your podcast. Like, I'm so fascinated by all the different guests that you've talked with in the past. And for me, I'm just so happy to see podcasts like this, you know, to see people from the community building up their own stories and reaching out to people outside of the community as well. And it was a delight to talk to you. I feel like we could write an entire book about these two different experiences, because I think it's always when you talk to someone outside of the community, it's like, oh, that's interesting, you know, and it makes me think differently about my own upbringing, my own experiences. So thank you so much for taking the time with me.
You're very welcome.
Thank you for listening to The Vietnamese with Kenneth Nguyen. Special thanks to Brittany Tran, to Jane Nguyen, Catherine Nguyen, Tina Pham, Sydney Jamie, and Christo Trinh. Please find us on Instagram, Facebook, and TikTok at The Vietnamese Podcast.